Thank you to everyone for moving rooms. We apparently had some attraction to male sexuality and Mormonism at the symposium. So my name is Chris Allen. I'm the chair. I wanted to welcome all of you here and especially thank the three panelists for coming. Glenn Lambert was originally talking with me about being on the panel, but then had a conflict in terms of dates and so isn't able to be here today. I'd like to just briefly introduce each of the panelists, then they will give presentations, and then we'll have an open question forum. I had this insight today that I was thinking about these panelists, and they were suggested to me by other people, and then I realized each of them has had some sort of mark on my sexual development, and I don't think they know that. When I was a returned missionary, I was struggling with being a sexual being, and so I signed up for counseling at the university, and Steve Paul was my counselor. Did you remember that? Yeah. Okay. Let me remind people of the confidentiality clause in therapy. And probably during the same period, I took an honors writing class from Franklin Fisher. And it was one of those classes where you had to write papers about something important to you and then share them with the class. And so I wrote on masturbation, which was something I was thinking about at the time. And Dr. Fisher was very receptive of that paper and encouraged me to rewrite it and publish it, which I haven't. I've kept that in the closet. And probably in the same time, I went to a B.H. Roberts Society and heard someone, I can remember exactly where he was, that it turned out to be Clifton Jolly, talking about wet dreams. And wet dreams. What? Yeah. Other people's, not his, of course. And when I called him to ask him to be on this panel, he said, "Oh, you want me to talk about my wet dreams?" So I'm looking forward to words from each of these sort of pinnacle influences in my sexual development. My father was this close to being on the panel, and that would have pretty much made everybody here. So anyway, I'll go ahead and turn the time over to Steve. We'll follow the program as outlined on the program, and then we'll have questions. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, I'm really pleased to see so many people here. And in my mind, it's indicative of what's happening not only in Salt Lake City, but across the country. And it's really exciting to me. I've waited a long time to have some opportunity to reach out to an audience that's interested in something other than just deriding men for the things they're incapable of doing. And the place I wanted to start is I wanted to talk a little bit about how I'm involved in, I guess, what's known these days on the cover of news magazines and in the media as the men's movement. And I don't think there really is such a thing, personally, but there are a number of activities going on around the country that really seem to be catalyzing into something that constitutes a national development, and a really important one in my mind, and I imagine all of you think so too. But in my own experience, I've been trying to lead men's groups in Salt Lake City for about 5 years, and when I first started doing them, I'd have four people show up and two people there at the end, you know, and that was kind of my experience of the men's phenomenon in Salt Lake. And I know there were some other people making attempts too, but something very different's happening now, and I think it's worth being aware of. Since the beginning of the year, I started offering a workshop called Waking Up Mail, and it seems like men have been flocking to it. And the men who show up, the first one I did, I went to it thinking I was going to have to use a crowbar and a little dynamite, and you know, I had a bunch of exercises I was going to push them through, and the fact of the matter was that I ended up setting them all aside because these guys were so ready to go and so ready to talk about their own experiences and get on with their lives that I never needed any of it. And that's proven to be the case ever since. And right now I'm running a couple of groups for men, and we'll continue doing the workshops in the area and the groups. And I never planned to be involved working with men. I've been doing therapy for years and years and years, probably about 70% women, 30% men for most of those years. And the shift has occurred in my practice and other people's as well. I think I'm seeing probably 50 to 60% men right now. And I'm sure that's partly because I've become a little identified with it, but also because something is happening. And if you notice, it's visible nationally too, not only in all of the media coverage, but two of the national bestseller nonfiction books right now. One is Robert Bly's Iron John, which has been number one on the bestsellers list for months on end, or at least in the top five, and a book by Sam Keen called Fire in the Belly, which is also a very nice book. And, gee, when was the last time you saw a good men's book in the top bestsellers list, you know? I've been working on my own book for men, and I went around the country going through shops, bookstores, and looking for these men's books, and you'd find shelf on shelf of women's literature, and then down in the corner in the back without a label over it were, you know, three books that were written for men. And in the last year, some very fine books have been written, and they're starting to hit the bookstores. And I think it's really indicative of something that's happening. And there are groups and workshops and retreats happening all over the country. What I wanted to talk about really quickly is what I think, and this is my own formulation of what I think is happening, and the process that people are going through. And I'll kind of keep it short and sweet for now, but I break it into three distinct parts. The first one I call growing up male. The second one I call shaping up male. And the third one I call waking up male. Okay? Yeah, I guess they could be called anything, but I like those names. The first one, growing up male, is the process that men and women, I mean, I could be talking about women in this sense too, but that men go through where they are introduced to their identity and they're introduced to the roles that they end up filling in their lives for a good period of their life. And John Bradshaw, he has a term that he talks about that I think is really a lovely term to describe it. He talks about falling under the spell. And with the men that I work with, that's what it feels like. It feels like a spell was cast. And they took on the role that they were handed, introduced to, through their fathers, in terms of their father's modeling, in terms of the way their fathers treated them, in terms of the way their mothers held expectations of them and reinforced them or punished them for ways that they behaved that were in line with the role expectations or out of line with them. Moving right on into their school experiences with their coaches and their teachers and their religious experiences and the kinds of reactions and lessons that they obtained through those people that they dealt with in those situations. Milton said this, and I think it really captures it pretty well. The childhood shows the man as the morning shows the day. And that's certainly my experience. You know, we think of ourselves as operating pretty independently in our lives, and free from those early influences, and many people make a real effort to separate themselves from those influences and disentangle themselves from their childhoods, but they aren't very far away. And I think it's really important for each of us to recognize the powerful influences. I think of it as being shot out of a biological and educational cannon, you know, and having our intentions and our desires and our wishes kind of superimposed on that cannonball ride that takes us a long way before the inertia runs out. Okay? And that's my sense of it, is that we really move through much of our lives during the period that I'm calling shaping up male, kind of under the spell of our early experiences. And I guess one of the ways I think of it is kind of like sleepwalking. And it's not that, you know, it's not to be insensitive to us as individuals, but so much of it is automatic behavior. So much of it is determined by the roles that we have adopted and been trained in. So much of it we're unaware of. So much of it is independent of our actual choices. And one of the ways that I think that's been nicely described is in a book by Jean Shinoda Bolen, who interestingly wrote a book about the gods in every man as a follow-up to the gods in every woman that she wrote. She says, "The conformity demanded of men in our patriarchal culture is like Procrustes' bed in Greek mythology. Travelers on their way to Athens were placed on this bed. If they were too short, they were stretched to fit, as on a medieval torture rack. If they were too tall, they were merely cut down to size." And I think that if you think about your own experiences, you know, many of us were either enlarged into our roles or asked to hold ourselves back from our full expression in order to fill those roles. And sometimes it takes a long time to realize what we buried inside of ourselves that is ourself, apart from those roles that we don't have access to. And that's the, I think many of the lessons that we got that we end up playing out, particularly as men, is we learn to control our feelings. It's a virtue for most of us. We're trained, whether we fall down and skin our knee, or we get knocked flat on our tails playing football, or we have a breakup in a relationship, or we get fired from our jobs, or whatever happens to us, we're supposed to be stoical about it and not show the pain. And most of us have learned to pride ourselves in the extent to which we can accomplish that in our lifetime. And it's a virtue I'd like to challenge. The other places it plays itself out are work as a way of forming our identities and fulfilling our obligation to perform and provide. And I think that becomes more of a sense of obligation and often resentment as we play our lives out than it is a fulfillment or a realization of our creative talents. I understand that you're going to get to hear a little more about sex later. I'm not going to talk a lot about sex for the moment, but certainly it plays itself out in our relationships and in our sexuality. And for most of us, our cultural and our familial experiences, whether we know it or not, set the standards that we play out in our lives and determine what we understand is possible in relationships. One of the things that we don't realize, I think, you know, on TV you see the effects of abuse and you hear about how violence in families is so destructive. What we don't talk about as much is what the absence of something does. If you haven't experienced the presence of intimacy in your family, if you haven't experienced the demonstration of affection, if you haven't experienced the expression of love, you know, that's an absent thing in your life. And I know for me personally, it was one that I had a great deal of trouble finding to introduce into myself, because it was absent. Some of those things were absent, and I had no idea, you know, when people would talk about them, what that meant. Finally, the last thing I'll mention in this regard is the addictions. You know, that's the way men cope. And addictions, in my mind, don't just include drugs and alcohol. They include sexual addictions. They include work addictions, workaholism. They include too much television watching, too many sports playing, all of the things that we do for distractions. Because like women, I think most of us learned that what we really wanted was not available to us. And because that wasn't available to us, we decided that we dang well better find something to substitute in its place. And when we feel pain and we can't express it and resolve it, we decided we dang well better learn how to bury that and distract ourselves from it. And that's what I hear a lot of with the men I work with. You know, a lot of involvement in other activities in order to take our minds off of the things that are really important to us. In fact, most of us have forgotten what those are. Okay, let me just mention before I stop here that last phase, which I'll call waking up male. And that's the part of life where I think you know, the cannonball kind of reaches its zenith, and you begin to feel the descent. And you realize that the trajectory has played itself out, and you're going to go into free fall here, and you don't even know where you're going. So you've either got to wake up and figure out how to pilot this thing and decide where you want it to go, or you're going to hit the ground somewhere and you may not even know where you landed. And that's the process of waking up. Valerie said, and I love this, the best way to make your dreams come true is to wake up. And I think that's a problem in many of our lives because we have confined ourselves to sleep. And Robert Bly talks about the descent into our feelings as an important pathway out of our blocked self-expression. And I think that is the pathway, and it's a challenging one for us and often very difficult, but it's certainly something I'm seeing men do across the country right now. One thing that's kind of nice about it is that it seems to come in one of two ways. About the mid-30s to late 50s, you get the chance to choose to wake up, or you find the crisis moment in your life that forces you to wake up. And, you know, for some men it's a heart attack, for some men it's a business failure, for some men it's the end of their second marriage or their first marriage or their fifth marriage or whatever it is. For some men it's a failed business. But the moment comes where the dream, the course that they were on, is not going to be fulfilled. And they realize they have to choose again. And hopefully they'll choose from the inside this time, not just to fulfill somebody else's expectations. In order to do this, it requires a fair amount of humility. That's a pretty important term in the work that I see. Recognizing limits and recognizing the need for help. You may notice that these are not usually the strong points in men. You know, we're told to be proud and strong and independent. So to make the changes we need to make, we may need to make a 180-degree turn and become humble and recognize limits. Then we need to heal those wounds and learn to express what's inside us. And that's the only way I know out of the dilemma that we really need to solve in order to not only to change our own personal lives, but to change the direction that we're forcing on the rest of the world. And I think the next step beyond this one is to enjoy a wonderful partnership with the women who we've largely been incapable of sharing this planet with. So I'm looking forward to that as the next talk I give sometime soon. Thank you.
Peter Sorensen impersonations are at 6:20 at the theater. That's great. I think I have my notes out of order. It's been a little like my sex life over the past 20 years or so. Let me begin by reading the description of the session published in the symposium program. panelists will discuss growing up male and being sexual within Mormonism, which I think is probably impossible. Although it is relatively common for females to discuss problems of sexuality and intimacy, males project an image of females discuss almost everything more than men do. It should come as no surprise they discuss their intimate feelings more as well. My sister pointed out to me, she's an attorney and knows a lot of stuff like this. She said that she discovered that men standing at urinals do not talk to one another. Pray do not ask me how she came by this information. But that women sitting in stalls talk, 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 talk. What do they talk about? I asked her. She would not say. Males project an image of sexual have-it-all-togetherness, when in reality, males have many significant concerns related to sexuality and intimacy. Well, not all of us do, but some of us may. And when we do worry about these things, I suspect we principally worry about whether we will get any. Each panelist may cover personal and general issues such as male sexual aggression and passivity, the difficulties of intimacy, and suggest possible ideas for integrating sexuality within a religious context. Right. And now I'm supposed to get real warm and new age with you, right? Well, if we are going to connect, or rather that's what we're going to talk about doing but not actually do, what we are actually going to do is relate without connecting. If we're going to do that, we have to get one thing straight between us. And I know what's happening now. You're picking up on all these sexual double entendres which I don't intend. Freud's the culprit. He turned everything into sex. You may remember he was man. The one thing straight that I want to get between us is that when I say sex, I'm not talking about love or relationship or intimacy or any of that foo-foo female stuff. Okay. I'm talking about the real thing. The thing that made your father go stupid when you wanted to talk about it. I'm talking about the part men talk more about than they do about it, or for that matter are capable of doing well. I'm talking about the part that makes you feel good rather than the part that makes you feel like being good. I'm talking about the part that will take you back to a bad man or a good woman even if you are a Mormon. I'm talking about the part that you have to spell when unmarried people are in the room. I'm talking about the part that is the wrong part of the Manichaean dualism, the physical, doable part, the part that is corrupted and capable of being corrupted more if you work at it, the part that sings like sound along a wire when you touch it and leaps like a spark ignited from silk when you touch it right. I'm talking about the part Joseph Smith talked about, the part he incorporated in the faith and made a token of the kingdom, the part he said would ascend with us to heaven, the heaven of this earth made heaven by our return into the garden of our own bodies and the bodies of them we love and who love us. And I just made a mistake. I said love, but what I really meant to say was sex. In the 19th century, sexuality, or sexual natures, whatever you're more comfortable with, even love. In the 19th century, there were only two people singing about the pleasures of the body, Walt Whitman and Joseph Smith, the homosexual and the whoremonger, depending on whose history you believe. Not that it really matters, because we've pretty much discounted both of their philosophies of the flesh, Mormons in particular. Gene England said this joke he tells that I like best about Brigham Young is that when they first got to the Valley, they sent out guys to see what the Valley was like and come back to tell them whether or not they should go in. And the guys came back and they said, Brigham, it's incredible. There's fields and streams and fruit trees and this beautiful freshwater lake right in the middle. And all we're going to have to do is sit around and eat the fruit off the trees and make love. And Brigham said, salt the lake. Well, I haven't come to talk about Brigham Young or Walt Whitman. What I want to talk about is what you want to talk about, what you've been waiting 2 days to talk about, what you hoped we'd talk about, in spite of what it says in the program, my sexuality. How many times has he done it? To whom need I fear he will do it to me? How typically male, you were saying, to be defining my experience in terms of his own more limited experience. But please, you needn't be ashamed of your desires to know, however perverse your interest. You are neither prurient nor a voyeur. You're a journalist. You are merely interested in news. I say this with the support of the most reputable scholarly publication focusing on Mormon sexuality, the publication that has written more about Mormon sex than God dreamed when he invented the tree and said, don't. Our own Height Report, cum Masters and Johnson, the Salt Lake Tribune. Of all the information, revelation, prognostication, and circumnavigation that has taken place at this season's Sunstone, one of the issues that most intrigued the Tribune was a headline statistic. 58% of Mormon women admit to having premarital sex, as opposed to 80% of the women in the general population. Well, this causes me to ask a few questions from the perspective of Mormon male sexuality. First of all, with all the strides made by Mormon feminists over the past decade, why are Mormon women once again falling so far behind? And a second question, where in the hell were those 58% when I was a teenager trying to find somebody to have sex with me? Now, you may argue that I didn't run in a very progressive or racy crowd, but I assure you that it wasn't due to any lack of encouragement from me or any of the other guys in the crowd. And I found most young women willing to do enough stuff to at least distract me from that cause celebrated in every literature of Western culture, save that created by Elder Packer, the deflowering of womanhood. I will tell you all the appropriate male fictions mixed with fact regarding my wet dreams. I had my first when I was 3.5 years old. I was dating regularly by the time I was 7. And I was lusting after the 42-year-old middle-aged mothers of my friends when I was 9. And, of course, they were lusting after me. I necked and petted and I read Playboy. But, oh, my stars and garters, I was a virgin. Stayed a virgin right up until I got married. Through my marriage, right into my marriage. In this, I was like most of my friends. I know this. As a fact, investigated, because the greatest celebrities in my mission, the Northern Indian Mission, which has since most sensibly been disbanded, were the elders who were not virgins. Over and over, we insisted that they confess their sins with women to us. And they did. It was wonderful. It got better every time. The best experiences of my mission. When I got off my mission, I did everything that I had heard them say that they had. I tried to do everything that they had said they had done. I figured that with my luck, I could get called on another mission at any time, and I did not want to again be the one who was listening to the stories. No luck. I got called into a college branch presidency, which, while it gave me a perfect vantage from the stand to choose the girls I would try to seduce, it remarkably confused the process of that seduction. It is almost impossible to construct a carnal relation with a woman who asks, "Do you think we're doing the right thing?" How the hell did I know if we were doing the right thing? further, they expected not your own opinion on the subject, but the Word of God. I guess that what I'm saying is that no matter how tough the paradox of sex is for women, how complicated the vicissitudes of attitude in the popular culture and the Mormon culture, it ain't easy for men either. Maybe eliminating from the temple ceremony the nonsense about women looking to men for advice will help, because this whole power thing about priesthood and administration and sitting on the stand may be nothing more than a compensation for the fact that men aren't any better lovers than we are. And I think that when it comes to sex, we may finally have touched on a territory where the church really cannot be blamed. Sure, as a kid, I felt the appropriate degree of guilt for the liberties I took and the desires I felt. But the fact is that every time I heard the brethren lecturing about morality, I looked at them and I knew they couldn't be getting any action. I mean, come on, Brother Packer talking about little factories? Reducing the spontaneous, joyous physicality of sex to a mechanistic symbol of industrial mass production? I mean, sure, men like to think of themselves as that way, but I am a factory. Yeah. Whatever the brethren might have wanted to do to decrease our sex drives, they were wonderfully inefficient in the process. We're the ones who screwed it. We messed it up. 58%? Come on. Where were we when we should have been having sex and making love? Probably at Sunstone talking about it. Learning about sex at Sunstone is like learning about free flight from a pigeon that's been run over by a locomotive. Or reading about it in the Salt Lake Tribune. What we should do right now is adjourn this session and retire to the parking lot. A woman and a man to the back seat of each car. Or if the most recent literature is accurate about the appetites of middle-aged women, three men and a woman to the back seat. Three very young men. But I digress. I believe the church's attitude about sex is pretty much its attitude about children. About 20 years ago, I was given an assignment by the Ensign to write an article on the church's theology about children. I did a lot of research, stuff like when Brigham Young said, and I quote, "Crying children in meetings are like good intentions in life. They should be carried out." That was the most profound thing I found said about children. When I was finished with my research, I realized that Mormons have no consistent theology about children. We suffer them. They suffer us. It's just like with everybody else's children. So I wrote a personal essay about the joyous trouble I was having with one of my kids, and the Ensign almost published it. It went all the way to Blue Line before one of the brethren pointed out that it really didn't teach one how to do anything. An accurate, if inept, insight. What was published several issues later was an article by a seminary teacher, 8 Ways to Be a Better Parent. I like that a lot. I long for something like that in the Ensign about sex. 8 Ways to Help a Woman Have an Orgasm. Fast. Eight answers to the question, are we doing the right thing? 8 phallic fundamentals of the faith, 8 reasons why however many times you're having sex a week it isn't enough, 8 positions, well, you get the idea. Now, let me caveat at this point. I have no complaints about my sex life for the past 23 years, principally because I married a woman who turned my life into a garden. When the more precise questions about married sex came out to be asked with a temple recommend, and when a bulletin came out explaining later on that oral sex was one of the things the brethren were interested in, weren't we all? The bishopric I was serving in at the time tried to be mature about it. We discussed the issue, we prayed about it, and the answer came. We could live by the letter of the law and never have normal sex for the rest of our natural lives, or we could find our way around the priesthood bulletins to the heart of God and, even more difficult, the hearts of our wives. And that's the key, isn't it? Hearts. Although in adolescence the locus of the emotion seems centered somewhat lower, it's what we feel and whom we feel it with. When shortly after my marriage I asked my father, a doctor of psychology, a marriage counselor, and a member of our stake presidency, what was acceptable sexual activity in a marriage, he counseled, in a loving relationship that is pleasurable to both you and your wife, anything short of whips and chains. My father was a happy man, and he made my mother happy. Now, I know we've got a lot of trouble, right? A lot of men not satisfying women, a lot of women frustrating men, a lot of sex that isn't working, and a lot of the time it's because the church is getting in the way. And maybe that's the way it should be. Maybe what God wants is to find out which is more important to you. The church? Well, good luck. Anybody who chooses even a good church meeting over even bad sex has put his or her brains where their chains should be. Maybe the Gnostics had it right after all. They thought there was a bond between the physical and the spiritual, that the Manichaean dualism of body and spirit was a fiction created by some guy who couldn't get... created by some guy. I wrote this really fast, you know. I mean, they painted their sacred statues with semen and prayed to God for orgasms that would teach them the ecstasy of believing. You want to know what it meant to me to grow up Mormon, male, and sexual? Kind of that. The mystery lay ahead of me, tempting, a little severe, but full of truth and hope. I lusted for it like I've lusted for not even poetry and position in the church. And when I found it, I discovered it to be even more full of magic and miracle than I had imagined. The most sacred of all creatures, it turned out to be the fulfillment of the medieval image, the two-backed beast, capable of all things moving in all directions at once. I made that thing. I misunderstood it, I abused it, I failed in my responsibilities to it, and yet I still love it, and it loves me, and it has taught me the mutuality and responsibility of love. Maybe that's why I'm able to be such a good Mormon. I was never so disappointed as many of you. I never thought the church would make me whole and teach me hope, a sacrament which sex already had performed. At the risk of being thought to be sensitive, I shall close with a poem. Hell, too. They made it out of magic, hermaphrodite, neither her nor him, but a copulating creature of their love. Or at least he thought they had, having read about it from the Middle Ages and dreamed it from all the courtly issues of that day, the all-in-all, the two-in-one. It was a mistake, a monster, gentle in its way, kind to children, generous to blind old men who still believed the possibility, but given to a rage. Remember me when I am gone away, the poet wrote, believing virtue lived on canvas before Raphael, believing love a word that could be spoken, a color or a shape. All the Magdalens, all the flowers dying bright around the body of the delicate Ophelia, speak of other things, of the moment love could not contain, of the word no poet dreamed, of the voice unheard we listened for. All those flowers still brilliant in a back room of the Tate were dead a century ago. And the girl who played the scene, gone too, nothing remaining of the monster except this bright denial, reminding me of what we did not make. I'm remembering fireflies and the Sisseton Sioux boys in East North Dakota who caught them, crushed them to spell glowing names of girls on their T-shirts. Lilith, I remember on the chest of a boy whose face I never saw. The night like the inside of a shoe, dark, warm, damp, and the smell of green leaves going greener to decay. I am remembering fireflies, wishing that I could do that to you, spell you on this narrow shirt, implode you till you burned in me with the same cool burning of that name, Lilith. The silent incendiary, the unreasonable flame of you caught here. In the dark room where I write, the light of afternoon gone down, and I not lit the light. I am remembering fireflies.
Excuse me, I've never seen a copy of the program. Well, since there's no time for revision, and since I didn't know that Chris had invited us to talk about our own Mormonness, maleness, and sexuality, I'm going to suggest we take a hypothetical case. A young Mormon male leaves his friends and family in the distant megalopolis where he is growing up, horny but virginal, and enters BYU as a freshman in the late 1950s. He expects to learn and to reconcile his learning with his faith. He expects to go on a mission. He expects to come back and marry a beautiful Mormon girl who won't mind taking off her temple garments during the act of love. He is tolerant of friends who drink and smoke. He is grave but charitable toward friends who have lost their virtue. He teaches the gospel doctrine Sunday school class in his campus ward using gospel ideals by David O. McKay and the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. He listens to debates among the other men in his dormitory about what you should do if your date blows in your ear. He agrees in principle with the ones who say they would take her home, but he's not sure that he would. He thinks he might talk to her instead. Am I coming through? In spite of an incandescent testimony, he loses his virtue with a young non-Mormon female in Salt Lake City, whom he must go to a great deal of logistical trouble to see every week, and who does not entirely comprehend why he keeps saying they have to stop doing this every time they do it. She attends the University of Utah, a hotbed of secularism, and doesn't have many Mormon friends, and consequently doesn't understand Mormons very well. In fact, she thinks Mormons are strange. Every Friday night, he boards the Greyhound for Salt Lake. Every Saturday night, flushed with guilt, he boards it again to return to Provo, where he arrives at dawn, takes a guilty shower in his dormitory, puts on his wool suit that itches more every week as his transgressions deepen. He leads the singing at priesthood meeting, the hymn book burning his palm. He takes the sacrament at Sunday school and feels the bread lodge in his throat, the water turn to acid in his stomach. In his gospel doctrine class, he stands before the blackboard, enlarging on the topic of eros versus agape, and feeling everyone's eyes fixed on him. It is a class made up of young unmarrieds like himself. They are his friends, his peers. He shares their beliefs and values. Mormons create intricate connections between sexuality and guilt is not news to anyone, nor does it make them unique among religious believers at large. I think it's arguable, however, that the peculiarly Mormon reading of sexuality is often responsible for a kind of lifelong adolescence among Mormon adults that hinders, in some cases, the development of a mature, fully realized love relationship between a man and a woman. Not everyone is taught that sex is simultaneously the reward for a virtuous life and the guarantor of punishment for an unvirtuous one. Mormons are. In one stratum of heaven, marriage and the marriage bed persist. In the other strata, people are deprived and miserable. One of the torments, we were taught, endured by the third of heaven not privileged to be born is that they see the blessed enjoying the pleasures of the flesh, and their hatred of the blessed is the more frenzied for knowing those pleasures are lost to them. Young Mormon males frequently grow up with the idea of sex as a negotiable commodity. Do not partake now and have it forever in the celestial kingdom. Or, as a Mormon writer friend once put it in a novel, you're getting it now, baby, so figure on hanging up your balls on the other side. Young Mormons are assured in general conferences or at firesides or BYU devotionals that even though this Old Testament prophet or that one had, quote, many wives and concubines, unquote, we were not to understand that he was getting it on the outside because his concubines were also wives. Once at a BYU devotional, I heard a general authority, I believe it was Marky Peterson, thunder about the sweetness and chastity of a hypothetical young Mormon woman and bring down the wrath of heaven on the hypothetical young man who could not restrain his lust and so pawed her and humbled her. Since I had pawed someone the night before who had pawed back, I was, of course, concerned. What is the difference between pawing and stroking? I hopefully asked my roommate, who was also a second counselor in my campus ward, Bishop Rick. A marriage license, he said. It probably is not surprising that to many Mormon men, sex early on becomes an end in itself because it is presented as a tease. It probably isn't surprising that it is often accompanied by the adolescent glee and furtiveness that accompany the purloining of any forbidden fruit, that part of its pleasure is in the fulfillment of fantasies that get cooked up in any reasonably healthy adolescent mind and that are never really gotten over. This is legal now, a friend told me she and her husband said to each other happily each time they made love for the first year they were married. Sexuality that is tinged with guilt can be hard to identify with love, still harder to integrate with it. Sexuality that was tinged with guilt before marriage and is tinged with celestial or otherwise duty after marriage may at least theoretically remain a separate pleasure forever, never quite occupying an unstudied place in a love relationship. Guilt can, of course, be pleasurable. So can duty. The young hero of my hypothetical case, repents or doesn't repent, serves a mission or doesn't serve one, becomes a jerk or a hero, marries a woman who likes to leave her garments on during love or likes to have him take them off. Each Sunday dawn, however, when he is teaching that Sunday school class at BYU and is the only sinner in the world, when he has gotten off the Greyhound and crept through fog-shrouded streets back to his dorm, when he has looked in the mirror and seen a face tainted with experience, and he knows in a few minutes he is going to stand in the house of the Lord, a hypocrite, he falls to his knees by his bed and prays. Help me, he says, hoping nobody is listening. Help me.
Well, I wrote the abstract over the phone after I asked these people to talk, and I'm really glad they didn't follow it. Let me just mention a couple of things before we open it to a discussion. If anyone would like to follow up on some of the things Steve has talked about, there's some pamphlets here on his workshops that I'm glad he brought. And You could probably read about that hypothetical situation, I guess, in Dr. Fisher's book, Bones, which is on sale outside. Let's go ahead and open it up to questions and discussion, and if you'll go ahead and address the panelists directly, if you'd like, and if people can't hear, I'll repeat the question. This is about how easy it was to find speakers for this.
Is this on?
I have more
poems
I could read.
Okay.
We have one question over here, huh?
Why do you think the church doesn't offer more positive models for the same problem? Do you go to
Why does the church not offer more positive models of sexuality? Are there any ideas on that?
Tough to find them on the stand.
Well, I used to be the father of teenage boys. I'm still the father, but they aren't teenagers any longer. What would you like to know?
Well, I have a real hard time. I'm just wondering if
So how to break the barrier and be able to talk to your sons about sexuality?
Well, I can only speak from my own experience, which of course is limited. My two colleagues here can help out. I think about the time my own children began explaining things to me, that I decided the time had long since passed when I could give them paternal advice. I guess what I'm saying is I never found that there was never an awkwardness in my own case, but then my own kids were not raised Mormon, so if that makes a difference, I don't know.
I have two teenage sons and three teenage daughters, and I think they should learn about sex where I learned about it, which was in the locker room. And the Indian culture believes that parents are the worst people in the world to teach children important things, except by example. And it disgusts my children to think of me as having sex with anyone. And it embarrasses them when I bring the subject up, but they are able to talk to aunts and uncles and a second-tier group, which is how the Indians take care of it. They always say, go ask your grandmother, go ask your aunt. That's what I do. Their grandmother's dead, but I say, go ask your grandmother.
Well, I only have a 12-year-old and an 8-year-old, so I'm free of that burden at the moment. But I will say this, that my suggestion would be to explain to your children how embarrassed you are and how difficult it is, and start from there. Start with the openness of your own experience, and you know, let that be the basis of your conversation. It won't be easy for them either, but you're expressing honestly your own limitations, your own fears, your own concerns is probably more important in my mind than talking about the sexuality that's going to follow, because it'll open, you know, many more doors for many more discussions, I think.
I've also made a follow-up question.
Do you expect me to say these as I repeat?
Could we see by a raise of hands how many feel this burning guilt? Just out of curiosity. Okay, that's fine. How many felt it but got over it? Yeah, okay, most of us. And how many of you, the things that you did were more pleasant than the guilt that you felt because of the things that you did? I wanted to do a follow-up to the the question, and that is that as inept as I am at teaching my children about sex, I am really unhappy when the schools or the church presumes to say they can do a better job. I know I don't do any job at all, and that's kind of the way I think God intends it to be. They'll go out and muddle around. But the problem of having the schools or the church do it is what Gore Vidal said. He said, you know, this is the most certain way to a kind of genocide. Because when you see what schools have done to really interesting things like history and literature, I mean, give them sex and we won't have any children after a few generations. So.
Question here. Her question is, the panelists address premarital sex, and she wants to some people to possibly address issues for a single person.
Any of us are available for dinner.
The parking lot theory, huh? Is the question post marriage again? I wasn't clear either. Divorced or just older single people? Okay, yeah.
Which of us are single?
Is it different than
is it less guilty for older people to do that?
Well, one point that I was going to address in my own talk, but somehow it got lost because of other things. Is that among Mormons, and I have to speak with limited authority on Mormon sexuality, but my understanding of it from that limited experience is that there are essentially three modes of sexuality in the Mormon hierarchy. One is, as one grows up, and again, I have to speak of male. So I may not be able to answer your question as a woman, but bear with me.
It's the best
it's we, the can, best do we
can
do.
giving all they
that,
can.
There is solitary masturbation, there is collaborative masturbation, and there is intercourse. And not all young Mormon males experience the third. Most of them, I suspect, experience the second, and all of them experience the first. Now, what happens in the case of the older Mormon male who never marries or who is divorced? I don't know, but let me give you an anecdote. My 90-year-old mother, who is a very strong Mormon in Northern California, was the daughter of a polygamist, the youngest daughter of a youngest wife. And so she had a great many brothers, half-brothers, who never, much older than herself. Some of these never married. She has speculated about what kind of behavior they were guilty of for never having married. I don't know. I know what I would have done had I been one of them, but I don't know what they did, and I don't know precisely whether she worries more that they got it on the outside or they didn't get it on the outside.
Franklin's is the most reasonable discussion of the subject that I can imagine, and it makes me never want to have sex again as long as I live. I mean, you know, every time you talk about it in those terms, it's these things should be discussed in loving partner with loving partners or loving groups or with a mirror. I mean, it's very hard outside of counseling, and we got only one counselor. Pass the mic.
I'm not entirely sure I understand what you're asking. You're asking about. Put it to
in
me again.
Culture,
I don't have an answer to that question from a theological point of view. From a personal point of view, I certainly would, and that I would give a private answer to that question. But I don't have a question. I don't know that. I don't participate. In making that kind of decision, so that one, I don't have an answer to.
That's how guarded we all are up here.
There's a question back here. The question is how a mother can possibly facilitate more connection between a father and a son.
So this is a situation where there's a good relationship between you and the father still?
Marginal.
Well, I am a divorced father, and I can tell you this, that to the extent that you encourage the children to have a respectful relationship with their father and encourage them to spend that time, that's a help from one side. It's awfully difficult without your support to be a father. That much I know. And in terms of helping the father, I think that to the extent that you can communicate with him directly about the kid's needs and talk with him openly, apart from your own relationship with him, about what the children need and ask him for it. I mean, that's the best you can do. Beyond that, it's up to him to follow through. And has been historically, I think, a fairly low percentage of divorced fathers who have. So, it's based on getting beyond the limits of your own relationship with your ex-husband and asking him for something for the kids.
Does anybody else want to respond to that? No one wants to talk about mothers. Against the wall? Does prohibition and repression when you're younger lead maybe to some acting out behavior? Is that your question? When you're older? Mm-hmm. When you're freed, are you more likely to maybe have an affair or something?
I heard a really terrific analogy, and the analogy was to a beach ball in the ocean and trying to hold the beach ball under the water indefinitely, you know. Absolutely, the beach ball will come to the surface. And so, you know, I think that's in response. I mean that feelings that you do not own and respect will run you, and they will manifest themselves and act themselves out in your life. So, you know, my point is, if you'll take responsibility for them and make conscious choices about them and not try to deny or ignore them or whatever, then you have some latitude about how you act them out in your life. If you don't take that responsibility, they will play you instead of you having much choice about them.
While Stephen was speaking, Franklin and I discovered that all three of us are separated from our spouses. I mean, what the hell do we know, right? But speaking for all three of us, I would like to go on the record and say that I personally have found that people who are separated are among the most moral and responsible and likely to do right people in Mormon culture. This is my personal opinion. And if you believe that, I have a freshwater lake I'd like to say.
In the back,
Well, one of my favorite stories has always been about the emperor's new clothes. The one about how how he was so vain and so full of pride that he had these tailors come in and make him a set of clothes that was invisible. And, of course, everyone had to say how nice they were because everyone wanted to support and maintain their position with the king. And I think sexuality is one of those topics that we walk around without seeing. And I think it's foolish. And I think we pay a remarkable price for not accepting our sexuality, accepting the sexuality of our children, and then making some maybe not altogether ridiculous choices about dealing with it, because it is a reality and it will play itself out. And I mean, you know, the statistics are probably low in terms of the real situation, and we can't pretend that it's not real. So we better deal with it as though it's a reality and then take responsibility for it as parents with our children and as individuals ourselves. We can't push it under the water and expect it's going to stay down. It won't.
We still have time for questions. Let me just say, if Sloan Smith is here, he needs to report to the registration table immediately. He or she. So your question is how to break through male-female barriers sexually. How to share the feelings that we won't share, I guess, is the question. Let me just, Sam Keen's book, and this is kind of blunt, but Sam Keen says, for men, the way to the heart is through the penis. And that's how they get to the heart, which I thought was a funny way of saying something.
That's an interesting approach. But I don't know. I feel really strongly about that, obviously. I mean, that's where I'm putting a lot of my effort right now, is to help men get in touch with those parts of themselves so that they can express them. And when I do another event that I think is kind of fun. It's called Naked Men, and we bring a panel of men in from the groups and invite women in to ask questions like this, and the guys just answer them really honestly, and it's really a lot of fun. But the answer that they came up with, or we came up with among ourselves, to the kind of question you're asking is, first of all, I think you really have to recognize that the vulnerabilities of the men and the limitations, and we are incredibly sensitive. And if you have any misbelief about that or doubt about that, you need to rectify it, because we are many times more sensitive than we appear.
Not all of us. We'll all be different.
I'm not saying
some of us are just kind of flat out assholes.
I think that the ones
right
of us
straight through to the soul.
Well, most of the time, in my experience, is the bigger the asshole, the more sensitive the guy that got hurt. Often that's the case, too. The bigger the asshole, the more women like him. I think that's absolutely true, and it goes the other way, too. That's true. That has to do with the dynamics of relationship, and, you know, that's the next phase. Resolving the dynamics that we create with each other is the next phase. But let me see if I can come back to your question. What I would tell you is that, and it's an answer to this one as well, you need somebody that's willing to answer two questions positively. The first one is, are they willing to work on their own stuff? If the answer is no, hit the road. And the second question is, are they willing to be an ally to you while you work on yours? If the answer is no, adios. And, you know, it relates to what you're talking about, too, because not many relationships actually have completed, either one of the partners completed the work they need to do to have the level of intimacy that most of us seek. It's going to require work on both partners' parts to be able to allow that. And so what you're looking for is, you're looking for somebody that's willing to do that work with you, somebody that knows they have to do it. If the person doesn't even acknowledge they need to do the work, you're in trouble. And I wouldn't stick around for that personally. I would highly recommend you not.
In against the wall back there.
Yes.
Do people marry for sexual pressure is the question.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, go through engagement in marriage, just do it.
Yes, next question.
don't I think that just happens in Mormon culture and Mormon
and do we differ? Does our culture, Mormon culture, differ? And do Mormons marry for sex more than others, maybe? Does anybody want to?
I
hope so.
I suspect they marry for sex at least as much as other people do. I suspect that they marry for sex at least as much as other people do, possibly more.
Hopefully they get married and they do it, you know. But
they get married prematurely, maybe in a relationship that won't work.
There's a study out of BYU's CDFR, which Family Relations Group, which surprisingly knows a lot about families. And they indicate that Mormon teenagers tend to neck and pet more and have sex less. And contrary to what you would think, they have a harder time getting married than people who have already had sex. And the reason they do is because the marriage goes on forever. They got no way out. You know, you make the decision and that's that. Or so they think. So forever is only forever in the mind of God, you know, as it turns out. But the point is that, no, there may be Mormon youth who marry for sex, but as a matter of fact, the other thing, the eternal marriage thing, tends to keep them at a distance more so that they aren't as free to make those kinds of decisions.
Why don't we take one more question in the back, and then we'll go to the parking lot. Has feminism made it easier or more difficult for men to feel sexually fulfilled? Have a good self-image.
I've been reading Something Something in Humanism. It's a horrible title. That argues that the whole idea of the female orgasm and the discussion of the female orgasm has been used by hardcore feminists as a means of persuading them that they don't need men, that the orgasm, as a matter of fact, is more a product of their own chemistry than it is any union. And I personally find that to be satanic in its principle. It may be true, I don't know, but it's certainly counterproductive. But no, I don't think... I think feminism has been as ineffective about sexuality as the church has been. You know, the two premier ineffective forces in the world, the Mormon church hierarchy and the feminist hierarchy. I don't think they've had any effect on sexuality at all for people who feel about each other. You know, I mean, how can they impact that with philosophy? Because with feminism, you're talking a political thing, and as opposed to this real carnal thing.
I have two comments on that. In the first place, I think that it has affected it in maybe the first way, kind of adversely, because I think it's made us more self-conscious, many men, more self-conscious. I think that now we're aware that we're being watched. And I think that's made some of us nervous, you know, to know that the woman is concerned about the sexual experience. You know? That's a nice novel idea that you have to take into account. So I think one of the first reactions was one of self-consciousness in a new way. I think ultimately, I think it has been a precursor to some of the things that are happening with men now. I think the men, when I first started seeing the men, they came in because women had sent them. Then they went away. Okay? The guys who are coming in now are coming in because they recognize that they need to fulfill their own selves. So I think it's starting to work its magic as men own it as their own needs. And any change that it's made in the awareness of women that will subsequently allow, with the change in awareness of men, for us to work on our sexual relationships together, ultimately will have a grand impact. So.
Well, thank you. everyone.